Joseph's incredible temptation. There's a great temptation that takes place in this home that Joseph is living in. You can go ahead and read verses 7 through 12 there while I'm talking if you like. But here's what's taking place. Potiphar's wife puts Joseph in an incredibly difficult position. She wants to have an affair with him behind Potiphar's back. And so what happens is she's putting Joseph's integrity, his spiritual life, both of which she's putting to the test. And so she's proposing to him a great, great temptation. Now, I want you to notice a couple things, and I'm going to read in verse 9 just because I want you to hear it. In verse 9, this is the place, this is where she has placed him in this temptation. But he doesn't yield to the temptation, and he gives us two reasons why he cannot yield to this temptation. Now, I'm going to tell you something. These are very important things for each and every one of us. When you are tempted with any kind of sin, these two reasonings that he comes up with are probably a very real part of your life as well in some form or fashion. He reasons that he can't yield to the temptation because he needs to maintain his integrity with people. Secondly, he can't yield to the temptation because he needs to maintain his spiritual life with his God. All right? And those two things are incredibly important. Anytime you're facing any kind of temptation, if you can force yourself to stop and think about this for a moment, think about your integrity with people and your spiritual integrity with God. It's important, and you will find that you don't want to yield to that temptation. But this is where he's at. Look in verse 9. There is none greater in this house than I. He acknowledges where he's at. He knows what he's doing. He knows the place he's been positioned in by Potiphar himself. Neither have you kept back anything from me but thee. The only thing, and this is not really anything Potiphar would have had to say. He would understand, obviously, that, you know, he has access to the entire household, everything in the household, everything he has access to, but obviously he doesn't have access to the man's wife, all right? And so he's just making it clear, I understand that you're off limits, all right? And I get that. And so he says, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? All right? So he gives us the two pictures. He says, I recognize that Potiphar has trusted me with everything that he owns. What kind of a man would I be if I took his wife? So he understands his own personal integrity. And he understands that, you know, he can't do such a thing. First of all, to a man who has trusted him as greatly as Potiphar has trusted him. You know, I find this interesting because he's essentially a slave to Potiphar. Potiphar bought him, all right? So he's essentially a slave to Potiphar, but he has been entrusted to such an incredible position, and Potiphar has so entrusted him in that. He doesn't hold Potiphar accountable for the slavery. He understands, that it wasn't him that took him into slavery. He gets that, you know. But Potiphar is treating him well and treating him, you know, as well as you could possibly be treated. And he's saying, my integrity will not allow me to cheat with this man's wife. I can't do that. So he understands his own personal integrity. But secondly, he says, I can't do this wickedness and sin against God. He said, but secondly, I could never betray God in this matter. I mean, not just man, but I could never betray God because God has done so much for me. We already know what all God's done for him. Everything he touches, he prospers according to the scriptures. So we know that God's with him. Well, we see why God's with him, do we not? With his integrity, with his spiritual integrity. And so we see where he's at. And so he's saying, I can't do these things because of all of this. And then in verse 10, she is absolutely relentless. And she has not taken no for an answer. All right, she has decided, I'm going to have this young man, all right? And so she's not taking no for an answer. And then verse 11, she finally has him alone. Nobody else is around. She finally has him alone, and so she makes the most aggressive move that she's made up to this point. And in so doing, I mean, she makes this move on him, and in verse 12, he sees no other alternative but to run, all right? He just flees. Now, I want to stop there, and I want to kind of hammer this for a little bit. and hold into this passage, because I think it's really important for us when we're dealing with sin. He gives us a real good picture of how to deal with this, but also, in the same turn, he gives us a good picture of some of the things and some of the outcome that can happen as well, you know, whether we want it to or not. But when we look in Scripture, in the New Testament, we're given this same exact command as to what to do when we have to deal with certain sins. And when we look at that, first, I'm just going to throw a few at you. 1 Corinthians 6:18, we're told to flee fornication. All right, 1 Corinthians 10:14, we're to flee from idolatry. 1 Timothy gives us a list of things that are incredibly ungodly. And then in 6:11, Paul says, flee all of those things. All right? 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 22, we're told to flee youthful lusts. So sometimes the answer, when you're wrestling with a sin, when you're dealing with it, sometimes the answer is just run. Get away from it. Just get away from it. You know, there are always going to be certain times in your life where things can be difficult. I learned my lesson when I first started pastoring. I hadn't been pastoring all that long. In fact, give you an idea just how long ago it was, my office was the ladies' restroom, where the ladies' restroom is now. And my office was in there. Before there was a ladies' restroom, there was actually a sound room. Before there was a sound room, there was a baby's crying room. But my office was in there at some point in time. So this tells you how far back we're going. All right? And one of the young ladies in the church was just wrestling with some huge issues and asked if she could talk to me. I said, I had no problem whatsoever. So, you know, she came in, talked. I left the door open, did all the things, you know, they tell you to do, with one exception, and that is that I met with her alone, all right? And so we're in there talking, and I'm sitting on my side of the desk. I've got her in a chair on the other side. It's like, you know, you keep all the distance. You know, I was smart enough to do all those things. And she began to look excited when she'd talk, and she'd get up and talk and stay there talking. But every time she sat down somewhere closer to me. I never thought about it at first until she was sitting in a chair right at the edge of my desk. And she'd move the chair. And I'm like, this is getting really awkward, you know. And I start to think, I'm starting to get really uncomfortable with this situation. And I told her, I said, you know, I need to stop you for a second. I said, I'm getting really uncomfortable with this situation. I need you to move back to that chair. Oh, no. And she goes, oh, no, nothing's going on here. I just need to talk to you. And that's just so far away. I need to talk to you right here. And I'm thinking, this is just not comfortable. And now from that point on, I've lost the conversation because I'm uncomfortable. And before the conversation got over, she's leaning over me. And I'm thinking, okay. And so I got up and I walked out. She goes, where are you going? I said, I'm going outside and we can talk out there. I'm not even going to stay in the building anymore. I just went outside and stood outside the doors until she came out. I wasn't even going to go back in the building. I just felt that uncomfortable. I don't know that she was doing anything. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to make it sound like she is just trying to hit on me. But I was really uncomfortable, and the situation was too awkward for me. And so I'm standing outside. I'd gotten to the point where I knew my only answer was, get away. Just get away. I don't know how many of you guys remember John Ashcraft, pastor around these areas for a long time, great man of God, but he would never, never, never let a woman ride in his car unless she rode in his back seat. You know, he'd cart them around anywhere they wanted to go as long as they'd ride in the back seat, you know. And it's just to prevent such things. All I'm saying is sometimes, regardless of what it might be, sometimes the best answer is get as far away from it as you can. Even if you don't think there's a problem, just stay away from it as far as you can stay away from it. If I've got a drinking problem, let's say I have an issue with alcohol, I probably do not want to have a ministry in a bar. You know, I probably, you know, don't want to even smell it. So if I've got an alcohol problem and I'm walking down the street, I might would want to walk on the other side of the street to avoid any opportunities. This is what's going on with Joseph. He's running from this temptation, all right? Not because he's ready to yield to it, But because he sees that she is going to be so aggressive with this thing that he's just got to get away from it. By the way, it's not just those types of sin, every sin. You know, I'm going to sneak over here to Marge and gossip about somebody for a minute. She probably needs to just get away. I don't want to hear that. I don't want to listen to that stuff. Get away. You know. Well, I want to tell you what so-and-so did. No, I don't want to hear what so-and-so did. I need to get away. We need to flee any type of sin. Just flee. Just get away from it. And that way you don't even have to deal with it. If you think you're so spiritually strong that you can deal with it, still run away. All right? Because we're not as strong as we might think we are. All right? So I'm just saying, the whole concept is he did what God had instructed the New Testament church to do. He did even in his day before there was a law or anything else. When the temptation got too great, he ran. All right? So good for him, right? However, the problem is this. Verses 13 through 18, when he fled, now Potiphar's wife's got to cover her actions. All right? And in covering her actions, she grabs his coat. And so when he takes off, she holds on to that so she can use as evidence of something so that she can make up a story. If he's not going to lie with me, then what I'll do is I'll accuse him of trying to rape me. All right? He tried to force himself on me. And so this is what she told her husband. And so she basically, what she did was she screamed and he ran and left behind the coat. And now, you know, she's got the upper hand. And having the upper hand, she tells her husband Potiphar that, you know, I know you trusted Joseph and so forth and so on, but here's what happened. Now, what's he going to do? He's going to believe his wife. He really has no other alternative but to believe his wife. And quite frankly, even if he doesn't believe his wife, he's going to side with his wife because it's what you do. You're one, okay? So what happens is once she shares that with him, it's all a done deal. It's all there. And here's another thing. She, even though they were alone, I'm sure that there were gardeners, there were people around the house that she brought in, well, says that she brought them in, and to use them as witnesses to say this really happened. And all they could probably testify to is I saw him running out of the house with no coat on. I mean, he was running. He was beating it. You know, like he knew he did something wrong. And that was going to be their testimony because they really only got one side of the story. And from someone they trust. And in addition to that, I want to throw this at you. I don't know if you might not have thought about this, but it makes a real point of telling us that he, being a Hebrew, was elevated to this position in the household. Keep in mind, all these other guys have probably been leaders in the household for a long time. And they're likely, some of them are probably Egyptians. Many of them work for Potiphar. Many of them are assigned to Potiphar. And all of a sudden, you take this slave, bring him in. He's a Hebrew. And he's over everybody. So chances are, all of these guys have got a bone to pick with him anyway. You know, they're all like, hey, you know, how did this happen? Why is... And now, they've got an opportunity to get back at him. So here's the deal. It don't matter if they believe her or not. They're going to side with her because it gets the Hebrew out of the house who is already over them in position, and they probably don't want him there. And so you've got all of this going on, so she knows she's going to be able to pull him in. You know, but isn't that the way of it? Isn't that the way we do? Isn't that the way many people do? You know, in order to make sure that you drive your point home, sometimes we want to embellish, even if it's the truth, we want to embellish it to make sure that we get as many people on our side as we can. You know, look at what happened. You know, let me see. I got to make sure I get as many witnesses as I can to make sure I really justify this thing. Even people that had nothing to do with this, let me drag them into it so that it may look like I've got a whole bunch of people on my side. It's a sad scenario. But happens, by the way, that happens in families, happens in churches, happens anywhere. And if they can convince you to be on their side, they're going to convince you to be on their side. So that it makes their story look better. That's what she does. She pulls them all in. All right? I'm going to throw an illustration at you that just something I'm aware of that I know took place at one time. I knew a pastor and his wife, and I'm not going to mention their names or anything. They weren't necessarily a personal friend. I just knew them. All right? some of the people that knew him very well were very close personal friends of mine, but whatever. But he and his wife had taken a teenage girl into their home to try to help her and strengthen her and try to, you know, encourage her. She had no home life. She was basically thrown out of her home. Mom or dad, whatever, were addicts, and they didn't want her. They couldn't care for her. They were in and out of jail. They were in and out of this and that and these and those. And all they were trying to do is help this young girl because she was just destitute. So they brought her into their home. And they made it very clear, we're going to bring you into our home. We'll treat you well. We'll take care of you. We'll treat you like you're one of our own. But you need to understand, a lot of the rules and stuff are probably not rules that you have had to abide by in the past. And so they had household rules that she had to abide by that she didn't really care to abide by, you know what I'm saying? And so one thing led to another. She got really upset with them because they wouldn't let her have this or they wouldn't let her have that. And they, you know, and she couldn't do this on her phone, couldn't do that on her phone, couldn't wear these clothes, couldn't wear those clothes, right on down the line. And he's going, well, you're going to live in my home. You're going to follow the rules. Well, she got angry enough that she made an accusation that he raped her, molested her. And they took her word for that. And so he winds up losing his church, put a strain on his marriage, even though his wife knew better. It just, the pressure and the stress and just made a mess. His reputation was destroyed. Even though somewhere down the road, everything worked out and she admitted that she had made up the story because they wouldn't let her have the things that she wanted. Still, he had already lost his church. His reputation was already tarnished. And a lot of people don't get that follow-up story. You know what I'm saying? All they get's the initial story because we like to hear awful stuff. And so it destroyed this man's life, literally, trying to help this young girl. Joseph is kind of a picture of that. And what we find is that sometimes even doing right and sometimes even doing those things God has called us to do, you know, you run into situations that you think are going to hurt you and you think are really, really bad. This situation, God used this situation, as we'll see later down the road when we're in Genesis, a little farther in Genesis, what we see is God uses these situations to put him in the places he needs him to be because he's got a big plan for Joseph. And what we don't always see is we see the tragedy and we see the hurt and we see the frustration and we deal with the stress and we deal with all those things, but we sometimes forget God is still in control. And if we'll just be faithful to him and we'll still trust him, God's going to move us through these things as we have to move through these things. And so even when things happen that we can't fathom being, you know, we think that's the worst thing imaginable, God still moves us through these things. And so as a pastor, one thing I've learned over the years is that, well, not only does, you know, not everyone tells the truth, And even those who try to tell the truth sometimes have a personal slant. It's still a matter of just trust God on this thing, you know. We don't always have to retaliate. We don't always have to have our side of the story out there. We just need to trust God in it sometimes. If you're ever in a situation where you're counseling somebody or if you're working in situations like that, let me tell you this. If you were a young pastor, I'm going to tell you, I wish somebody had told me this when I was young because I think it's one of the most important things I could have learned. Anytime you're counseling situations where, you know, maybe there's arguments, maybe there's, you know, people that just don't get along, don't gee-haw together, maybe there's just a problem, do not take sides. Do not take sides. Be the mediator. Always be the mediator. One of the worst things that will happen if you're marriage counseling especially is if you side with either the one or the other. Because if you side with one or the other, then what happens is you become an advocate for that person and you're no longer a good counselor and you're no longer a mediator. And what happens is you become the person then that they always come to because they have found somebody that's going to side with them. And if you've ever came to my counseling sessions or if you've ever been a part of that, if you've ever dealt with me, you'll know that's how I deal. I try very hard not to take sides, even if I in my mind think one person is incredibly wrong and the other is not. You know, I try very hard not to be that person that just takes sides because when you do, you're no longer a help. When you do, you just become that person they can come to and get support for whatever it is they're trying to gain. So what happens is, in this situation, is when these guys were witnesses, they just took her word for it, and they became her supporters. And so what you have is all these supporters that are coming against Joseph. And so Joseph has only himself to speak, even though none of these people saw what happened. None of these people were involved in what happened. They were all drug into it. But what happens is they took sides. And Potiphar took sides. Nobody sided with Joseph. So there he was, the only one that was true, the only one that was right. But because they had so much support and strength, you couldn't get a fair trial if you would. All right? That happens all too often. If you're going to be a counselor, understand and know, be a counselor, be a mediator. Stay in the word, be biblical about the whole thing. And don't, whatever you do, don't just pick sides. Take those sides. Worst thing that can happen. All right? And then what happens is this, as you move on into verse 17, we see that his wife was stirring this up even more because in all likelihood, as I said before, all these guys were Egyptian leaders. So, you know, brought all those into this and made this sore point really, really even worse. It was just a thing to rally them behind her. Then verses 18 through 20, what we find is Joseph is relieved of all of his duties. And he's put in prison and basically forgotten. All right? Here's a guy that, you know, really prospered well for Potiphar, but now he's just gone by the wayside. Isn't that kind of an interesting thing? Doesn't matter, you know, how much you do. It's what have you done for me lately? You know? I feel that way sometimes as a pastor. You probably deal with this stuff all the time. You probably deal with it with your kids more than anything else. But it's like, after everything I've done for you, and you're going to treat me this way? You know, I know I've said that to my kids. I'm sure I have. As a pastor, you feel that way sometimes, you know. I've had folks get mad and leave the church, or, you know, over something I've said or done or preached or who knows what. And I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, okay, let's say I am wrong. Let's just say I'm wrong. I mean, I've counseled your family, helped keep your marriage together, visited you in the hospital, prayed with you, baptized your children, led them to the Lord. You know, I have visited relatives of yours. We have spent fellowship time together. We've been out to eat together. We've talked together. We've been friends for years. But today ends it all, you know. And it's like sometimes it just leaves you scratching your head. So I know Joseph has got to feel betrayed here, you know. He's got to feel like he's been betrayed by Potiphar, but he's been put in prison and just forgetting. By the way, you'll find out in chapter 40, apparently Potiphar has a prison in his own home. I mean, his home apparently sits up over the prison, beside the prison, whatever the case may be. But he has one for that he pretty much deals with. I'm sure they have other prisons. But this is the one that Joseph has been put in, so that Potiphar is there and is a part of that. All right, he's always over him. And so this is where he's at. But in verses 21 through 22, again, we see God's intervention. Here he is in jail. All right, but God works and moves in his life and deals with him in such a way that the keeper, the jail keeper, realizes, you know what, there's something special about this guy. You know, God's got his hand on him. And so even within the prison, the keeper kind of moves him up the ranks within the prison. By the way, in jails and such, I don't know what you know about them, but that happens. I mean, for example, just, you know, you'll start with maybe you can get to be what they call a trustee. And basically, you're given special privileges over and above the other guys. And sometimes, you know, you can even be the guy that they have to come to talk to about going and getting special privileges. All those things can't happen. So what happens is when he's in jail, they're like, this guy's pretty special. Maybe even Potiphar went to the keeper and said, hey, listen, my wife accused him of this, but I'm going to be real honest with you. This is a pretty good guy. That could have happened. I don't know. But nonetheless, even in jail, everything he does prospers, to the point where he is put in charge of basically everything that a prisoner can be put in charge of. And that's where he's at in jail. So the very things that took place in Potiphar's home in that regard is now taking place in the jail in that regard. All right, so we're going to leave off there, pick up in chapter 40 next week. But he's in jail. He's prospering. He's in charge in jail as much as a prisoner can be in charge. Any questions about Joseph? Yeah. Well, he could have done anything. Absolutely. Potiphar probably had a rank so much so that he could have done anything he chose to do. Here's the thing, and obviously you know this, but keep in mind God's hands on Joseph. That's not going to happen. All right. So, you know, God's watching over Joseph. If God was going to let Joseph die, his brothers would have killed him. All right, he'd already been dead. You know, so obviously God's got his hand on Joseph, watching out for this. You know. Yeah, absolutely, Linda. You know, that's a possibility. I don't really know. He may very well have expected him to react the way he did. I don't know. You know, I think that he respected Potiphar in a great way, just by the fact that he had, you know, Potiphar had trusted him the way he did. So I think he had a lot of respect for Potiphar. And there's never any indication ever really that Joseph lost that respect. Here's something about Joseph that really intrigues me. And Joseph's like this his entire life. Everything we see in Scripture about him is, regardless of how he is treated, his integrity is always really high. He doesn't respond based upon the way people treat him. You know, he always deals with them the way he thinks God would have them to deal. And you see that in Joseph's whole life. You never really ever see him make poor decisions in that regard. You know, he is always a man of integrity. And I think that is so important, because here's what people tend to do. And you know, we say we love the Lord, we love the brethren, but if somebody says something to us, and maybe they're legitimately wrong, maybe it's out of the way, maybe they shouldn't, we react the same way they acted, and then we talk about how awful they were to come to us that way when we actually did the very same thing back, you know? And we're as guilty as they are because of our reaction. And too often we're like that. Joseph acted and reacted the way that God would have him to, rather than based upon how he was treated, you know. So his integrity was what it ought to be, and that's what really, that's part of what integrity is, you know. You can tell a person typically by their reactions more even than by their actions, because when they're caught off guard, you know. And it's kind of funny, but back several years ago, I had a lady here. She's no longer here, and I'm not going to mention her name, so it doesn't matter. But we was always joking back and forth, and she would come out at the front door, and I was just pulling up, and I just blew my horn, and it scared her. And she jumped and turned around and blurted out a big naughty word. And, you know, and I'm like, you know, now I feel bad because I blew at her, because her reaction wasn't anything like her typical actions, you know. Then she felt bad, and it made it real awkward between us then from then on, because she knew I knew, you know. But a lot of times our reactions don't have the integrity they ought to have. Yeah. So it might have been Dad after all, yeah. Yeah. No, we're not either. No, we're not. Now everybody knows you. Yeah. Huey McCord. We're gonna put it in lights, Huey. Have a seat.
Do it. I want you to do that.
We got more to do, Huey. There you go. Without a doubt. Have a seat, Huey. We need to get our business meeting, okay? All right, guys. Any last questions? Okay. We're going to go ahead and consider ourselves in order for transactions.